Matters. I'm your host, Lindsay Hughley, and joining me today is Jessica Gobladia. Jessica is an attorney and mediator with a deep expertise in probate, guardianship, and mental health law. A member of her firm's probate, trust, and fiduciary litigation group, Jessica helps individuals and families navigate complex legal processes with clarity and compassion. She earned her law degree from Loyola Law School in Los Angeles and holds a bachelor's in economics from Boston College. Licensed in both Texas and California, Jessica has represented clients at the state, federal, and appellate courts, including the Texas Supreme Court. Her holistic perspective and experience on all sides of these matters make her a trusted advisor and mediator. Welcome, Jessica.
Thank you for having me, Lindsay. I'm excited to talk about this today.
Yes, I am too. So today we're going to kind of dig into how your work connects with fiduciary litigation, estate planning, and then their broader financial landscape. But first, we always like to hear on Banking Matters how our guests kind of landed in their specialty field.
Sure. So I actually started out in commercial litigation. I represented hospitals. And so a very unnatural transition to probate and guardianship, I guess. But really what happened was I had hospitals where patients were there and couldn't get care they needed. They needed a guardian. So we would end up assisting trying to find a guardian or get a guardian appointed. And then, you know, probate, creditors' claims, a whole host of issues, powers of attorney came up, whether or not they were valid. So I came from a commercial litigation background and then found my niche into probate and guardianship. And my practice really started to grow when I went out on my own in 2017. And I started doing a lot of court appointee work, attorney ad litem, guardian ad litem work. And so that's really how I started into the area more substantively and then grew the practice area. It's also where I started learning how, you know, orders and banks don't always mesh.
Yes. And so today I would really love for us to dig in and hear your perspective of what you guys as lawyers wish that banks knew. And just kind of go through these different topics. And I would love to start with power of attorneys. What is it about them that would help you guys as lawyers if bankers were aware of, if we knew?
Sure. So I think the number one thing with a power of attorney is there's this conception that a valid power of attorney has to be done recently, right? Or that it has to be a state of Texas power of attorney. The reality is, although estate planners recommend that their clients update their estate planning every 5 years or so, most people don't. They wait 10, 15, 20 years. And if that's the case, they have a power of attorney from 2005. And that's not going to look like today's power of attorney. And I think it throws a lot of bankers off, right? The other thing is somebody moves from Massachusetts to Texas. They have a Massachusetts power of attorney that's still very valid. It just doesn't look like our Texas power of attorney, right? So I think the first thing I wish bankers knew is that just because it doesn't look like what we're used to seeing being seen doesn't mean that it's not valid. It just means, oh, wait, let's pause and let's look at it, right? So if somebody comes in with a power of attorney that's not your standard form, that's okay. Talk to your manager, talk to legal. There is a section in the Texas Estates Code that allows you to get a certification of a power of attorney that basically says that the person presenting the power of attorney to you is attesting under affidavit that this is what it is, and I still have the authority to act under this power of attorney. It hasn't been revoked, and it's still active and valid. And that gives some level of protection to the banks. So number one, trust but verify. It's a power of attorney. I like to think the best of people.
I think we all do like to think the best of people. And I have heard trust but verify many times in reference to POAs, but I had never heard of a certification of POA. So would that be an easy ask for a bank to ask of a customer when it's something that they can't explicitly validate or if it's old?
It is. So the trust but verify the certification, it's a form, right? Some banks have a form that they prefer to use. I've dealt with some kind of mid-sized banks that often have their own form because their legal department is more involved in their day-to-day, right? And not, but the bigger box banks, I think that's sometimes harder to get a Texas-specific form because they have counsel from outside of Texas and they're not familiar with some of our laws and you know, kind of our oddities, I think is the right word. So this certification basically is it can be a form. I draft it for my clients a lot. And I pulled up the estates code because when I tell you it's a form, the Texas Estates Code section 751.203 calls it the agent certification. And it gives you a list of nine paragraphs that should be included. And it's things, you know, hi, I'm the agent. This is a validly executed power of attorney executed on this date. It's still in existence. It would be really helpful if bank leadership would educate their bankers, their front lines on this statute, because even if the person can say, hey, you need to go to get a certification of durable power of attorney, the person could Google it and it's going to come up with Google or AI and follow it. And the beauty is this is under oath, under penalty of perjury. It's going to be an affidavit. But if you, for example, had one at a bank with an unsworn declaration section so that your bank isn't notarizing it, the person could fill it out with the unsworn declaration and the bank could accept the power of attorney. Because I do think so many bankers know their customers so well, especially the elderly customers, that they really want to help them. And this would help to continue that service seamlessly.
Yes, because my experience, I've always worked in community banks that are very tight-knit communities where they do know their customers, and they want to go out of their way. But this process, like I said just a second ago, I didn't know that this was necessarily a thing. So I think this would be really beneficial for all of our listeners, like if to look something up like this in their state, in their own state law. Because it would be great. Because again, I feel like community banks, their goal is to help as many people as possible. And so this would really help remove what I feel like is a huge speed bump or roadblock in accepting and taking on power of attorneys for customers.
I agree. And you know, if you tell somebody, hey, this is an easy option and they don't want to complete it, then maybe that trust but verify becomes more, you know, hey, okay, I really have to go talk to my manager. I really need to get legal involved. The other thing that's really important with powers of attorney, and I had this conversation with somebody the other day, a power of attorney is no longer effective once somebody dies. So if somebody comes in with a death certificate in one hand and a power of attorney in the other and says, oh, I can do this, I'm their power of attorney. No, you can't. So it's just a, you know, it makes sense to me, right? I'm a lawyer, I deal with this. But people can be very convincing and say, no, I can do it because I'm the agent under power of attorney. So if somebody says that the account holder is deceased and they have a power of attorney, again, just stop and say, well, hold on, whose power of attorney do you have? You know, if it's the decedent's, I'm sorry, I really cannot accept that. You don't need to tell them it's valid. The other kind of more sensitive areas with powers of attorney, I think what you're going to see a lot in the coming years is springing powers of attorney. So a power of attorney can be effective upon execution immediately the minute you walk out the door. Or it can be springing, meaning you have to have letters from a doctor saying the person's incapacitated and it's only effective on that date. But because, you know, the legislature likes to keep us on our toes, there's now the option to make it effective immediately for somebody, for example, a spouse, but springing for children if they're the successor agents.
So the spouse would have it until the something incapacitates them, and then the children
Yes.
would have it.
Yes. So say John names his wife Jane as the first primary power of attorney and it's effective immediately. That means Jane can use her power of attorney as soon as they walk out of that attorney's office. Say Jane becomes incapacitated or passes away before John. So Jane can no longer act as John's power of attorney. And John's successors are his daughter, Carrie. Okay. Carrie can't act under that scenario until John's deemed to be incapacitated. And that requires one or two letters from a doctor saying he's incapacitated and can no longer make these decisions. But that requires a couple of things, right? One, that the doctor's letters are present and stapled to that durable power of attorney. And two, that the bank has looked at that power of attorney to know that it was immediate for one person and springing for the next. And I do think that's going to start getting tricky because this is going to be a relatively newer thing in Texas. Now, practically, I love it because I do want my spouse to be able to make action on me if I'm not available. I don't know that I want my 21-year-old son able to do it unless I'm incapacitated, right? So just really, and this is going to be a common thing, reading what's before the banker.
Right, and that's what I was going to say is it is it to me it feels like it's always so important to have more than one person, especially frontline, be capable and aware enough to be able to sort those and understand where are you looking, what are you looking for, where should it typically be at, and how to kind of go through and validate that. So I think that's great that you're bringing up this springing, because I have not heard that either.
I will tell you, as an attorney, when I'm appointed as a fiduciary or a guardian ad litem or as an attorney ad litem, and we'll talk about this, I think, a little bit later. One of the most frustrating things for me is when I walk into that bank and they have the concierge and they look at me and basically say, "I'm sorry, what do you want me to do?" And I'm like, "I need to talk to somebody." "Well, do you have an appointment?" "Unfortunately, no, because the court told me it's urgent." And so those first probably 3 minutes of interaction can kind of set the tone for what's going to be the relationship for the next week, month, year. And I think that banks and their employees have their job, obviously. And I try to be very sensitive to that. And I think most of my colleagues do too. But I do not think that we always feel that it's reciprocated, because our job is so very different than the banks protecting a person's privacy.
For sure. And it can be so complicated, but like I said, a lot of this falls on the training of bank staff, and I really hope that, to me, if I was in charge of that, I would want my employees empowered and knowledgeable about the different types of situations, and it's not, these are not going to be situations that you see on a daily basis, but having access to procedures or one specific person in that branch or the corporate office that you call to validate all this information, but just having them be aware that this is even a thing so that they know who to go to. It would be so beneficial.
I think that's another great theme of this is policies and procedures, right? What happens? So many times I've walked into a bank and they've said, "Oh my goodness, I don't even know who to contact for this," especially the smaller banks. "We don't have a contact person for this."
And like I said, it's not something that it's just not an everyday occurrence. And I've gotten to help a little bit with some of this too, because again, most of the banks that I work with are smaller community banks. And again, these are not frequent items or documents that they see very often. And so as we kind of move through this, do you have any other points on POAs that you'd like to point out?
I think at the end of the day for POA, the other important takeaway is if you know that somebody does have an agent under a power of attorney and a banker suspects that they're maybe misusing the funds or they're seeing, since this POA has taken over, they're seeing, more money movement that's not between, for example, investment accounts for investing, that's not for paying mom's health care, her facility bill that you're seeing normally. There's more cash withdrawals reported. If you see something, say something. Elder exploitation and financial abuse is on the rise. And I think what people don't realize, and I think because we don't necessarily want to recognize it, is it's often the people closest to the elder.
Absolutely. And I've seen just in the last 12 months, I've seen two different cases of where a POA has taken advantage, or their actual caretaker, who wasn't the POA, was just handling everything that wasn't related to the person they were caring for. And so it is gut-wrenching, for sure, to watch that and then to try to figure out how to navigate reporting it and managing it from a bank standpoint. It's a heavy, heavy load.
It is. And you guys do, I mean, banks offer a very necessary service. And, you know, banks, I think it's less now because people don't go into banks as much anymore. But I know the bank that I use regularly for a lot of my fiduciary accounts, I walk in, I know them. It was great the other day. I wrote a check that was to, you know, somebody different than my normal on an account. And they emailed me and said, "Hey, just want to make sure that this is correct." And
awesome.
I loved it.
Yeah. Yeah. And definitely I'm always question, because when you question if you are doing things for the right purpose, then your answer should not, you should not be hit back with defensiveness.
Right. And, you know, other things, if you have somebody saying they're their power of attorney, just because they say I am her power of attorney does not mean they are. You have to see it to believe it. They have to have that document. There's no document, there's no power of attorney. Doesn't need to be an original. It can be a copy. It can be a copy that's been, you know, that's antiquated, 30 years old, but they have to have the document. It can't just say, I am it. You know, I think that's the biggest thing, is making sure they are presenting you with a document, mainly also for the bank's protection, right? For your own records. But if somebody's coming in and saying, oh, I'm her agent, they always let me do this. Well, where's the power of attorney? Where's Miss Jones?
Right.
Let her come in.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so as we move from POAs, I'd like to touch on trusts, because those are another quirky little beast that banks often come in contact with. And sometimes they can be so complicated that banks just kind of freeze. And so what is it that you guys would like for bankers to know about trusts?
Trust could probably be an entire episode in and of itself. So I'm going to keep this relatively short and say, use the principles from the POA.
Okay.
Get a certification of trust.
Okay.
You don't need the entire trust that's 20, 30, 40 pages long. The 2-page certification will say, I'm the trustee, I have the authority, it's still valid. Review that certification of trust to see what it says. Is it John and Jane as co-trustees? Is it just Jane? Is it Jane and John individually of each other, or is it joint action? I mean, and I have known a lot of banks recently, and again, it frustrates me as the attorney, but I also understand it if I was representing the bank. They won't take joint trustees where there has to be action taken jointly because they can't monitor it.
Right.
So again, same idea as with the POA, review, review, review. Look at the certification of trust. Is this person who they say they are? Is this the trustee? Now with the trust, you know, if the initial trustee passes away, then there may be a successor trustee named, and the bank may never have known that. And that's okay, because they don't have to have been told that. But that certification of trust will say, yes, John was the trustee, but he is now deceased, and now Jane is the trustee.
Yes, that's a situation that I've gotten caught up in, is when the original trustee had passed and we did not have the successor information. But then also it's, like we said about POAs, it's reading, having someone who can be able to discern what is accurate from those documents and be able to follow that.
Yeah. So again, trust, just like POAs, I mean, again, this could be an entire episode, but what you're looking at is the certification, the document, make sure you're reading it. And I tell people all the time, colleagues, clients, everyone, there's no such thing as a stupid question. And I mean that sincerely. Every question is a good question, because either you're going to learn from it, or you may be preventing a mistake from happening.
Right.
Customers may be upset because of the question, but if it saves them from having money taken, in my opinion, it's worth it.
Right. And I've always coached my employees that I've been over, is you have to operate from good intentions, and those always show through. And so when you've got the customer's best interest, even if we are asking hard questions at the end of the day, we are still serving our customers to the level that is expected.
And I think that's important for attorneys to remember too, is that the bank is serving a customer, just like we're doing a job. The bank is serving a customer, and you guys are bound by state and federal regulations that, as probate and guardianship lawyers, I'll be honest, I don't always know all of the intricacies of your regulations because,
There's a lot.
I mean, yeah, you're, yes, there are so many. So we're trying to balance both ways, right? We're trying to balance what law, what estates code, what finance code we're working within.
Yes. So next, this is something that I get a lot of questions on, especially the validity of them, but court orders sent to a bank.
Yes. So court orders, it's a frustrating thing for an attorney to appear with a court order. And I want to be clear, I'm talking about me as an attorney, as a fiduciary going in, because my clients do it as well. And this applies equally to non-attorney fiduciaries, but I can only speak from my experience. But court orders are court orders, right? The judge signed them. I can't tell you how many times I've had a bank tell me, or I've had a colleague tell me that a bank has accused them of forging a judge's signature because it's a stamp. And I'm okay. Number one, judges aren't signing things in blue ink anymore. It is a stamp. It has a date on it. It does look quirky because it's no longer what, when I started practicing, it's no longer the flourishy, big judge's signature. It's a stamp with a date and time on it, and then it's available on the public records in most counties. Okay, in most counties. But that's the beauty, right? If you're in a county that has public records that you can go access and you have a question about an order, and it's public access, go pull it.
That's a really good idea.
So, I'm in Texas, Harris County, Texas, Montgomery County, Texas. It's all open to the public. You can go view the order. So if there's really a question about whether or not there's an actual order or if somebody signed the order, go pull the record and look at it. Ask them for a certified copy of the order. And again, I'm speaking from experience with Texas. Harris County, if you pull something off the website, says unofficial across it. But you can buy a certified copy of the order from the county clerk. So if, again, if something looks strange, say, hey, can you bring me a certified copy of the order?
And
I
I've
don't
had
think it's
that
unreasonable.
just in the last, and this was in Texas. I've actually had a bank that an attorney brought in the order, but that it was just a blank copy before they had submitted it. And I was like, to me, it doesn't look like this has been filed or approved. And those are things that I'm looking for when I'm trying to validate a court order, when those come in, because in my experience, they do look different across the board, but I'm still looking for that official, that it has been filed, that it is in there. But looking them up on the public database, that's a really good idea too.
And so you made a great point that I didn't even think to jump to, is make sure the judge signed the order, because I could see a world in which somebody says, here it is. The judge will sign the order, and sometimes they'll sign it at the bottom of a page, and sometimes it'll actually be over the judge presiding line, but there will be a signed order that's actually signed by the
When
judge.
we got it back, it was signed. Like you could tell there was a difference. But at the first time that they tried to submit it, I was like, oh, I think we're missing something.
So the other option, again, some clerks are friendlier than others. Call the court and ask. Again, the clerk's office might say, oh, we'll go look it up. Well, how do I do that? But I truly think that if you were saying, I'm trying to comply with the court order, I'm trying to do what the judge is telling me to do, I just need to confirm it exists, I think a clerk would be willing to say, yes, it was signed on this date, or I have no idea what you're talking about. It's not there.
Absolutely. And so to me, this would be another step of validation that banks could put in their procedures. And like you said, you've had people say they don't know who to call, they don't know where to even go. And we've gotten so many great points even so far in this conversation that banks can go out of their way and take it upon themselves to validate these things or what to specifically ask for.
Right, and I hate to put it on the bank to do it, but if you're faced with something that looks just not right or something feels off, it's a simple way to do it without alerting the person you're talking to as well. I mean, because if it really is a bad actor, I don't know about you, but I don't know that I necessarily want to put them on notice that I have a suspicion.
For sure, I would not want to.
So court orders, right? We all know what they are. You deal with them all the time, Lindsay, I'm sure. And I'm sure you encourage banks to comply with them because I don't know anybody who says don't comply with a court order.
I don't want that on my conscience.
Right. I mean, because if you don't comply with a court order, you can be show caused, you can be held in contempt, you can be sanctioned, you can be responsible for paying the attorney's fees to get, the whatever the court order said you're supposed to do. Now, if I'm at a point with a bank, just again, personal experience, and I'm saying, look, if I can't get this done, I'm going to have to go to the court. I'm trying to avoid it. I'm not saying it going in there and, just saying, I'm going to do this. It's conversation after conversation after conversation and being told no.
Absolutely.
And so lawyers can be quick to threaten court intervention because that's what we do. I don't think it's necessary, but I do think there's at some point where you don't have an option to get compliance. I've had a bank, for example, where I was appointed a successor, and they told me they were going to call the removed executor to get permission, even though I had a court order. And it's very frustrating because in that sentence, they have told me, one, they're not willing to comply with the court order, and two, I don't know that they're actually going to cut off the removed person's access.
And
So the response to it.
there's a lot of moments where, as far as my positions that I've been in, and especially with the banks that I work with now, have another lawyer review it, go to legal, have them give their stamp of approval or help you navigate why you don't think it's legit or the qualms that you may have with the document. So that's always my, usually if I can't figure it out, that's usually the first thing I suggest.
And that's one of the things I wish you guys had, phone an attorney on call. I know it's not possible, but have legal, again, if there's a question, have legal review it, or have a training process where there's a manager on site that has some training in reviewing these things.
Yeah.
And so they know when to escalate it. I've
Absolutely.
gotten quite the Rolodex of outside counsel for different banks, that I can call and say, hey, I'm having a problem here. Can you help me out? And it's typically taken care of in a split second once there's another attorney on the line. So I think that's the other interesting, fascinating part to me is when I come in with a court order, I say, who can I talk to? And they say, basically, nobody. You talk to me. And I say, well, it would be really helpful if I could just have a direct contact to your fiduciary department, your guardianship department, your legal team, somebody, because we speak the same language.
And at the smaller banks, that their lawyer is still going to be, the legal department is still going to be an outside counsel that they have on retainer. And I can also, sometimes your new accounts people or your frontline, they are not going to be aware or have access that that is something that they could escalate. So again, it does come back to awareness of bank staff and knowledge of the managers, the head tellers, the office managers, and everything.
And I can attest to the fact that I have gone to the same big box bank, different branches. And what one told me was going to take 5 days was done in 2 hours in the other. And the difference was the training. They knew who to call.
And honestly, from a compliance standpoint, training always makes a huge difference. I'm super passionate about it because it empowers your employees to be able to do their jobs to serve their customers, even in these tricky circumstances. Because like I said, these are all very unique situations that do not happen every day. So every single teller is not going to be exposed to this. But they can be if you have regular training that you bring this up. And you have procedures that they can locate. So this is great.
And I would love that. And I mean, another on the lines of training is, again, reading, right? Reading and review. Read the entire order, because just because it says order, say it says order appointing guardian, that doesn't mean that it is guardian of the person or isn't. It is guardian of the estate or isn't. It just means guardian. So sometimes the powers in that order might include estate powers. So you have to make sure that you're seeing everything. Guardian of the person typically doesn't have authority to go get bank information. So I'm the guardian. Okay, but where in your order does it say that you can access bank accounts? It doesn't. So reading the extent and limitations of that court order becomes really important to see what you can actually help with, right? And I would hope that nobody would go in there and demanding access to bank accounts when the order doesn't give them that, but oh my goodness, I don't know. I've seen Stranger Things.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You don't ever know. And so that's why, honestly, having that person, that point guard at your branches, that someone can take that information in and assess it to validate it.
So can I tell you what my dream world would be if I walked into a bank?
Absolutely.
I would love to be able to walk in and have that point person, whoever it is, whether it's the manager, the concierge, whoever it is, and just say, hey, look, here's a court order. Here's my card. I know you've got to go through the legal process. Can you send this to your legal process and either have them contact me or you contact me? And then we'll set up a time for me to come back in for that hour to 2 hour appointment to do what we need to do.
Yes. I do. I have had attorneys, they've emailed over to my banks the documents, and then we hash things out, and then we get back with them.
And I do that with a lot of the banks that I know, right? But there are some banks that you can't get to that level of person,
right,
to even start that process.
Right.
And I think if banks had that at the front side, it would be super helpful. And honestly, it's a great marketing tool with attorneys, because the more we know that you're working with our estate accounts for us, for our clients, the more when a client says, hey, do you have an idea of who I should use for my mom's estate or guardianship account? And I say, oh, you know what? They're really well trained. And those words have come out of my mouth. They're very well trained and they know how to handle this.
Yes, my dad has actually been the clerking master where I live my entire life. And he if it is not court appointed as to where he's needs to go or the money goes or what he needs to do with the accounts, he has specific people that he works with because they understand the process and they are well trained and they are so familiar with it, and it makes his job 1,000 times easier. And so I've grown up hearing his side of it. As well.
So it's funny you mentioned that, because again, I kind of polled a bunch of lawyers and said, top three things you wish a bank knew, right? And a lot of their responses were the same, but the one that stuck out to me the most was, I'm billing hourly. I'm billing by the minute. I don't want to have to bill a client or an estate for this process that shouldn't take this long.
Right. Right.
And I think that's lost on a lot of people that's just how it works. So we want it efficient, right? We want time efficient. It's not rude. It's not short. It's just, we'd like to be as efficient as possible.
Absolutely. And so what about the nuances around letters of testamentary and administration and guardianship?
Yeah. So there's one big thing that, again, you need to be careful, because in a temporary administration or a temporary guardianship, you might not get those letters, right? In Texas, you get a letters of guardianship, letters of administration, letters testamentary. But when it's a temporary, they have the order and a I think some clerks call it a certificate or some clerks call it a certification, but it's not the same thing as letters. And a lot of counties just changed it, I think, to meet what the law actually says. So they're a relatively newer thing in our area. So you just need to make sure that you're looking at it and seeing that it's the right certificate, it's letters. But if there's a signed order with the certificate, it should be there. But something to be wary of, just because somebody comes in with an order appointing them as guardian or administrator doesn't mean they have letters yet, because they still have to qualify. They have to sign their oath. They might have to file a bond. and they don't get those letters until they actually qualify. If they're not qualified, they don't get the letters and they don't have the authority to act yet. So the order alone without the letters or certificate may not be enough. Again, training, hey, come back with the letters.
Yeah, for sure. That would definitely help in a lot of instances. Again, at the end of the day, everyone is trying to help our clients, our customers, and be the best advocate for them too.
Yeah, and so I guess one thing that I wish bankers knew is that if it's a dependent administration or a guardianship, we're what we like to call mother, may I? It is being watched. I can't do anything without court approval. So you see the letters of guardianship. What I see in the background is an annual allowance allowing me to spend X amount a year, X amount a month. So I don't necessarily know that banks and their employees know that we're under such a strict regiment of making sure that we're complying with every court order. Executors and independent administrators in a deceased estate are different. But if you see dependent or guardianship, we're bound by the court's orders. We're asking to spend money. So it's not like we're just going in and taking control of the funds and, you know, using it. I don't write a check unless there's some sort of court approval.
And then lastly, we'll kind of wrap up with the guardianships. And so what about those nuances? And I feel like we were already kind of leading into that.
Right. So guardianships are a special brand of beware. Okay. Once a guardianship is in place, a ward can't sign anything. So you can't tell the guardian to go have the ward sign something saying that they can access the account. That letter of guardianship, that court order is what gives that guardian the authority to do it. If the ward's been found totally incapacitated, they shouldn't be signing anything. And you don't want them to sign anything as a bank. There's no need for the power of attorney to give permission either at that point. It's a court order. Typically, the powers of attorney are going to be suspended if there's a guardian appointed. Hopefully, you know.
As soon as you said that, yeah. Was kind of the order of. So would that... suspension of the POA, would that be in the guardianship paperwork as well?
So in a temporary, look for that language. In a permanent, I would assume they're suspended. That's the safest assumption. Gotcha. And if you have a question, you can always check the order. You can always check with the court. You can check with the guardian. But assume it's been suspended. Temporaries are a little bit different. There's typically language in there suspending them, though, specifically. And so really quickly, you know, guardian ad litems are not guardians. They're typically attorneys appointed for best interest. Attorney ad litems are appointed to represent what the ward wants. Most of the time, both of them have authority to go get those bank records, though. And it should be built into the order. And I would suggest that bankers, I often seek an amended order explicitly stating I can get any financial accounts belonging to John Doe. So that the banks don't have to question me.
Right. I've often seen that as well in my experience. They're usually spelled out very clearly.
The one thing I won't have, though, is the account numbers typically. Just beware. I don't have those. I try. But, you know, I think banks also need to be aware that you guys, banks have this 24-hour day response rule for a lot of requests. But I think guardianships arguably are one of the exceptions to that. You really have to go look at the estates code 1054155. That talks about notice to the consumer from the court, not the bank, from the court that records are going to be accessed. And then the finance code chapter 59 discusses discovery of consumer records when there's a guardianship involved. Okay. And so it talks about compelling records. And I think banks and their counsel really need to look at how those two interplay. And part of that's because when there's a guardianship filed, there's typically some sort of urgency we're not normally seeing.
Right.
So the other beware is the court investigators. Court investigators kind of have this carte blanche access with similar to APS, in my opinion, to go and get these records. And they do have a court order. And I can tell you, I think judges, obviously I'm not a judge, but I do think that there's some frustration with judges about people not being able to get court orders from financial institutions. I'm sorry, people not being able to get records from financial institutions despite a court order. Because the judges are saying, why aren't you doing this? And we're saying, we're trying, I promise.
And so, kind of to wrap it up, I know that when you receive any of these documents, what about speaking on your experience with the consequences of closing or freezing accounts? What does that kind of, what are those implications?
It can really turn a ward, especially a ward's estate, into turmoil. You're shutting off potential mortgage payments. You're shutting off insurance payments, car payments. You basically could be shutting that person's entire world down just because you got a guardianship order. My job as guardian is to protect the ward and their estate. And when I get appointed, my goal isn't to throw everything up in the air and, have to put it back together. My job is to keep the status quo in the estate intact so that I can then calmly and in an organized manner rebuild the estate in a guardianship account to make sure everything is set up correctly. So there may be some overlap where, even in a decedent's estate, right, where the account is still open, but I'm trying to transition direct auto pay. And it really, really is frustrating and heartbreaking when somebody's insurance, like health insurance, gets shut off.
And so, are there reasons behind why, or is it mainly misunderstanding with the documents as to why a bank would close or freeze these accounts in these situations?
I think so. I think sometimes banks just, the teller doesn't know what to do. And I'm saying the teller because they're the front line. Or sometimes I think they might get the order, and in my experience, somebody else, the POA or an upset kid, has come in and caused wreaked havoc on it. And so the bank says, okay, you know what? We're going to protect everybody and shut it down. But I would say if you're going to make the decision to shut down the account and you know that there's a guardian, you know that there's a valid POA, call them, email them, tell them.
Awesome. And so, as we wrap up today, Jessica, do you have a piece of advice that you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think I'll go back to the beginning. There's no such thing as a stupid question. If you have a question, ask. For the leadership of banks, I really, truly love when I walk in there and I know that your employees have been trained. It makes the experience more enjoyable. And I'm talking professionally, right?
Yeah, of
And
course.
it's always nice to work in tandem with the employees rather than butting heads. And I do think lawyers, we do try, even though we can be very abrasive sometimes. So I apologize on behalf of all of us for that.
Well, thank you so much, Jessica. This has been such a beneficial conversation, and I'm so excited for our listeners to be able to take these actionable steps and apply them to their bank. And thank you again for your time. And for the rest of our listeners, that's Banking Matters.